You are listening to This Week in Palestine. I am your host, Anne Lucas. Welcome, ahla wa sahlan. Your ears do not deceive you. You are listening to This Week in Palestine from WZBC. And I am your new host, Anne Lucas. And you were just listening to some brand new music from the Palestinian artist Saint Levant. This is from his newest releases, Daira, which just released this past week. And it's now available on all streaming services, and you should definitely give it a listen. I really cannot express enough what an honor it is to be sitting behind this mic taking over this show. I am truly standing on the shoulders of giants. It was a sad loss to our community to lose John Roberts. May we all live in the light he has shown us. So I know I have some very big shoes to fill, and I am truly humbled by that task. I'm going to do my best to fill them and will always be thinking about the amazing trail that has been blazed by this show. It truly means a lot to me to be with you at this moment in the journey towards Palestinian liberation. With that intent, we'll be hearing a little bit later about some thoughts on the Nakba from Iyad el-Baghdadi. For me personally, Iyad is an important thought leader and activist in the democracy and liberation space for the entire MENA region. He is also Palestinian, and I found his reflections on the Nakba for Nakba Day 2024 to be very insightful in this current moment, and I think you will too. But first, I want to share an excerpt from a talk Ilan Pape gave on October 19th, 2023 at the University of California, Berkeley. With that, let's get started. You know, I am a scholar of the Middle East myself, so I often feel like Ilan Pape does not need any introduction. But of course, he absolutely does. He is currently a professor of history at the University of Exeter, and has been in very high demand since October 2023. This is because he is the leading historical authority on the Nakba of 1948. He's also a leading proponent of doing oral history on Palestine with Palestinians and Israelis. His work is probably the best-known example of Israel's new history, at least here in the United States. The new history of Israel involved Israelis themselves accessing their own archives and discovering the truth of Palestine. Ilan was famously, or perhaps infamously, kicked out of the University of Haifa for his research that resulted in his seminal book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. And the rest, we say, is history. The title of his talk is Crisis in Zionism, Opportunity for Palestine? October 19th feels like a lifetime ago at this point. You can find many, many more recent interviews with Ilan than this recording. But I keep coming back to this talk at this particular moment in history. I have found it really helps me keep perspective at a time where perspective is easily getting distorted and lost, at least for myself. So I wanted to share one section of it today. In this excerpt, Ilan is giving advice to activists like us about the need to combine the work for justice in Palestine with a deep historical knowledge. I really find what he had to say about these things so useful and inspiring, and I hope you will too. So with that, here is Ilan Pape.
The Palestinian people, since probably 1929, probably since 1929, are involved in a struggle for liberation. It's an anti-colonialist struggle. It's an anti-settler colonialist struggle. And every anti-colonialist struggle has its ups and lows. Every anti-colonialist struggle has moments of glory and has difficult moments of violence. Decolonization is not a pharmaceutical process. It's not a sterile process. It's a messy business. And the longer the colonialism and the oppression, the more likely that the outburst would be violent and desperate in many, many ways. And this is so important to remind people of the history of the rebellions of slaves in this country and how they ended, the revolts of Native Americans, the rebellions of Algerians against the settlers in Algeria, the massacre of Oran during the fight of the FLN for liberation. This is something which is part of the struggle for liberation. You can sometimes question some of the strategic ideas. You may have some uneasy moments, and rightly so, about the way things are being done, but you can never lose your moral compass if you don't decontextualize and dehistoricize the event itself. You seem to be in a struggle against a typical coverage, both by media and academia in this country and in the West in general and in the global North in general, that has this ability to take an event and start with the event as if it has no history. It have no consequence. I mean, even the stories about the kind of party or festival that was attacked on the 7th of November does not mention the fact that this was a festival of love and peace, kilometer and a half from the ghetto of Gaza. People were celebrating love and peace while the people of Gaza, 2 kilometers from that fence, were under one of the most brutal siege in human history that was going on for more than 15 years, controlled by the Israelis, deciding how many calories are getting into the Gaza Strip, deciding who goes in, who goes out, and keeping 2 million people in the biggest prison, open prison on earth. All these contexts allow you to navigate, I think, morally, without losing that compass. But far more important than the immediate context, and even the context of the siege, and this is what I would like to focus tonight, is the fact that one of the biggest challenge as activists for Palestine or scholars on Palestine who are activists is that we cannot challenge decades of propaganda and fabrication and counter narrative with sound bites. This is our main problem, I think. We need space. We need time to explain the reality, because so many outlets, so many sources of information, so many places where knowledge is produced has portrayed a picture, an analysis of Palestine, which is false, fabricated, and has been built throughout the years with the help of academia, the media, Hollywood, TV series, and so on. I mean, these are media that works on people's minds and emotions, and they created a certain story that you cannot challenge with one soundbite. You cannot even challenge it alone by your sense of justice. You can only challenge it if your sense of justice is based on profound knowledge of the history, a profound and accurate analysis of the reality by using the right language, because the language that is being used even by liberal so-called progressive forces is a language that immunizes Israel and does not allow the Palestinian anti-colonial struggle to be justified, to be accepted and legitimized. And, you know, in the pantheon of anti-colonialist struggle, which many people would put a lot of heroes from Nelson Mandela to Gandhi and to other important leaders of anti-liberation movement, you will not find one Palestinian. They will always be treated as terrorists, whereas by essence, they were an anti-colonialist movement. And that kind of insistence of using the right language, of knowing the history of the place, and having the right analysis is something, as I said, you need space for doing it. You can't sort of come and say you're wrong and I'm right. And this is a huge challenge for all of us, I think, in a moment like these days in America, for instance, where there seems to be this unconditional support for Israel and hypocritical approach to the suffering of Israelis that was never displayed towards the suffering of Palestinians in any given moment in the history of Palestine. The history lesson, so to speak, that is the antidote to dehistoricizing the events of the 7th of October and the events that are unfolding in front of our eyes today and probably in the next few weeks, if not months, the historical context has, I think, two levels, two basic pillars on which they should stand, and I think are very important for anyone who is involved in public debates on an individual basis or an institutional basis, on an academic domain or the media domain. It doesn't matter. The same kind of pillars are relevant to all these kinds of struggles. One is never to let go from our insistence of an accurate definition of Zionism. This is so important. You should not allow any discussion of what goes on in Israel today or in Palestine today without talking about Zionism. And this is why, and it's not a coincidence, so much effort has been invested by Israel and its supporters in this country and in other countries to equate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, that if you ever mention the word Zionism, you're already in the dangerous domain of being regarded as an anti-Semite, and therefore you will be ably be silenced. But that doesn't mean that this is not the only and right way to start the story. The story starts with an ideology which is racist. At its very heart, it's a racist ideology. It belongs to the genealogy of racism, not to the history of liberation movements, which is how it is taught in most American universities, not to the history of national movement, as it being taught in most of the global north, or is talked about or covered by the Western media. No, it belongs to the history of racism, an ideology, not in its very origin, but in the way it manifested itself on the land of Palestine. And this racism is part of the settler colonial nature of the Zionist movement, namely a movement which is not exceptional, which you are familiar with in this country as well, of Europeans who were chucked out of Europe and had to find a different place to be Europeans in it because they were not accepted as Europeans. And they found countries in which other people lived. And as the late Patrick Wolf said in that encounter, the logic of the elimination of the native was activated the moment these settlers met the indigenous people. And that is true about Palestine as well. Eliminatory policies were the DNA of Zionist encounter with the Palestinians from the very inception of the Zionist movement in the late 19th century. To put it in less academic words, you wanted as much of Palestine as possible with as few Palestinians as possible. There was always the demographic dimension and the geographical dimension, the population dimension and the space dimension. The more space you have, the less you want the indigenous population in it. Eliminatory policies could be genocide, could be ethnic cleansing, apartheid. They take different forms in different places, and they take different forms in the same place according to capacity, historical circumstances, and condition. But you cannot take out what happened in Gaza from these Israeli, and before that, Zionist eliminatory policies, from the elimination of the native. An elimination of the native that began first in Zionist thought, in the drawing of Zionist painters, in the writing of Zionist thinkers, and became a strategy in the 1930s that was first implemented in 1948 in the ethnic cleansing of Palestine that ended with the expulsion of half of the Palestinians and the destruction of half of Palestine's villages. By the way, many of these villages are on the ruins of these villages. Some of the kibbutzim that were occupied by the Hamas for a few hours were built. These kibbutzim were built on the ruins of these Palestinian villages from 1948. And quite a few of the Palestinians who went into this kibbutzim were a third generation of Palestinian refugees from these very destroyed villages not far from Gaza. This is also part of the story. Not everything that I'm saying here means that I'm justify everything that was done. No, I don't. But it means that it gives you an historical context without which you are not getting to the source of violence, and you're only dealing with the symptoms of the violence. And you need to go to the source of the violence. And the source of the violence is a certain ideology, a certain racist ideology, a Zionist ideology, that at its very basic is the idea of the elimination of the native. As I say, this is not entirely unique for Zionism. There were other European settler colonial movements who definitely were motivated and inspired by the idea of the elimination of the native. So if you look in a very cursory way on that history, you understand that what is really important for an ideological movement that is motivated by the idea of having as much of the new land as possible with as few of its native people as possible, you understand that what is really important is the historical period in which it was conceived and the historical period in which it enacted its policies of elimination. Now, if you enact these policies of elimination in the 19th century, as had been done in the United States, you're talking about a world that is quite indifferent to colonialism, to racism, and other human rights, collective human rights, or civil rights. But if you say to yourself, wait a minute, this has been done after the Second World War. It was actually done in the year of the Declaration of Human Rights that the Global North was so proud of, as saying to the world after the Second World War, we now have moral foundation that would make sure that the massive killing of people, as we've seen in the Second World War, that racism that we have seen in so many places would be eradicated because there is a moral consensus. When you think in the same year, South Africa issued the apartheid law and Israel exercised the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, you begin to understand the message that both the apartheid regime in South Africa received, and more importantly, the Zionist state received in 1948 from the international community. Yes, we are proudly announcing the Declaration of Human Rights, but we're also telling you it does not apply to you. It does not apply to you. The message from the world was that the ethnic cleansing of Palestine is acceptable, mainly for the reason, I mean, this was the propaganda. I don't think it was the real reason, but it was the kind of saying, in the words of one American intellectual, it was tolerating a small injustice to correct a much bigger injustice. Namely, Palestinians had to compensate the Jews for 1,000 years of European and Christian anti-Semitism. And the deal was very clear, and this is why Israel was the first state to recognize a new Germany. People in Europe and in the West were very hesitant whether to accept West Germany as a member of the civilized nations so few years after the Nazi regime. But the moment they got a green light from Israel that pretended, and not rightly so, to represent both the survivors of the Holocaust and the victims of the Holocaust as the ultimate representative of the Holocaust, they said, we will declare a new Germany, and in return, we want non-interference from the West in what we are doing in Palestine. You would have expected Israel at least to be the third country that recognizes a new Germany, not the first one. But it was very important for them to have this deal. Also, it also meant that the new Germany provided Israel with a huge financial assistance that helped to build the modern Israeli army already in the early 1950s. Now, when the message from the world was that ethnic cleansing is, in the case of the state of Israel, an acceptable method of national security strategy, it's not surprising that the ethnic cleansing continued. Israel expelled 36 villages between 1948 and 1967 inside Israel. Israel expelled 300,000 Palestinians from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip during the June 67 war. Israel expelled from 1967 until today almost 700,000 Palestinians from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And as we are talking, Israel is continuing the ethnic cleansing in places such as Masaf Yatta, the South Hebron Mountains, the Greater Jerusalem area, and other parts of Palestine. Ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian became the DNA of Israeli policy towards the Palestinians, and it employs hundreds of thousands of people to exercise it, because these are not massive ethnic cleansings like in 1948. These are incremental ethnic cleansing. Sometimes it's the expulsion of one person, of one family. Sometimes it's not even an expulsion. Sometimes it's a closure of a village or enclaving the Gaza Strip. It's also a form of ethnic cleansing, because if you create the Gaza ghetto, you don't have demographically to calculate these 2 million Palestinians in the demographic balance between Arabs and Jews, because these Palestinians have no say in the future of historical Palestine. This is the one historical pillar that is necessary for anyone telling us or using this vile language that people are now using against the Palestinians, when people tell us that if we wave the Palestinian flag, we are supporting terrorism. If people compare what happened on the 7th of October in the morning to the Holocaust, and by that totally abusing the Holocaust memory, either they don't understand or they don't know what they're doing. But even if they go with it and take the high moral ground, it's so important to locate this particular event into the wider, distant history of modern Palestine and the particular history of the siege on Gaza that began in 2007. The inhuman siege of 2 million people in one of the longest, probably the longest siege ever on such a large number of people in terms of food, water, freedom of movement, and other basic necessities of life that led already the United Nations in 2020 to think that life in the Gaza Strip is unsustainable for human beings. Already 3 years ago, they thought we already crossed the red line in Gaza. So don't be surprised if when people go out of there, there is outrage, there is revenge, there is violence. Of course there is. There was, same happened with the rebellions of slaves, of indigenous Native Americans, of colonized people from India through North Africa. Anti-colonialist struggle, as I said before, is not a work of Quakers and pacifists. It's can be very violent and can be very peaceful. And much of it depends on how much the colonizer the ethnic cleanser is willing to take in the fact that the people who are, that they are colonized or oppressed are not going to disappear and are not going to give up their struggle. The sooner you understand it, the more likely you will have a much peaceful transformation from a colonialist reality to post-colonialist reality. If you refuse to understand it, it will hit you in the face again and again. And the 7th of October is not the last moment of such an event.
Again, that was a section of Ilan Pappe's talk at the University of California, Berkeley on October 19th, 2023. Ilan telling us it is not enough to be seeking justice and coming from a place of justice in order to find justice for Palestine. And that has a lot to do with the current information environment. And this is why knowledge and making room for knowledge is essential to moving forward with justice for Palestine. At the end of the show, I'm going to share an announcement with you and some information with you about how you'll be able to access this entire talk and how we'll be able to provide that for you. It's really a fascinating talk. This is the middle section of three, and all three are interesting. There is also a Q&A, and one of the questions in that Q&A is about student activists and how they are going to deal with, you know, disciplinary actions that threaten their ability to have careers. It's crazy we were asking that question in 2023 when it is now only a more pressing question now. And you can imagine that Ilan Pappe has a very important kind of experience with that himself to bring to answering those questions. So we do want to make sure that you can actually hear the whole thing and have access to other types of contextualizing resources. I am beyond thrilled to share with you some reflections from Palestinian activist Iyad El-Baghdadi. He made these comments about the Nakba this past May for Nakba Day. Iyad is one of the founders of the Kawakabi Foundation, a foundation that was born out of the Arab Spring. It envisions and works towards a world free of tyranny, in which society trumps the state, extremism in all its forms has no appeal, and individual rights are sacrosanct. Iyad is also co-author of the book The Middle East Crisis Factory. I highly recommend this book, and I very much support the work of the Kawakabi Foundation. I've been financially assisting them for quite a while now. Interestingly enough, Iyad fell a bit backwards into this level of activism for democracy in the MENA region. He first made international news when he was summarily deported from the UAE in 2014, and this was directly tied to his political speech in support of the Arab Spring. As a Palestinian refugee from a family that had been living in the Arab Gulf for multiple generations, deportation left him with nowhere to go. His weeks of surviving in an airport in Malaysia called attention to the uniquely problematic position of stateless Palestinians in a world of nation-states. That was a bit of a long introduction, but I wanted you to understand where he's speaking from. He's speaking as the director of the Kawakabi Foundation currently, but he's also referring back to multiple incidences in his life, as well as stories from his ancestors. And this incident in the Malaysian airport will be one of the first ones you hear about. You'll notice that he makes reference to the Nakba in multiple types of ways, not just a specific event, but almost as a structural concept. And he refers to the work of Rabia Eghbariya. This is in reference to a law article that Rabia wrote. He is a doctoral student at Harvard. The title was Towards Nakba as a Legal Concept. So you will actually hear Iyad elaborating on and working with this concept of Nakba as a broader legalistic kind of concept for a state of being beyond the actual specific event of 1948. So let us listen to what Nakba means to Iyad.
Well, it occurred to me that today is 10 years since I was expelled. Like, May 13th is 10 years since I was expelled from the United Arab Emirates. I was taken to the airport in chains, and I had 5 minutes to see my family. And then it was living in an airport for the next month because I had literally nowhere to go. And it just happened that I got stuck in Malaysia. I mean, I spent a day stuck in Abu Dhabi, and then I was stuck in Kuala Lumpur airport for a month. And it just happened that it was Nakba Day, 2014. Until that moment, the Nakba was, in my conception, or at least in my consciousness, in my psyche, it was an event. The idea of the Nakba as something ongoing or a structure rather than an event was not something that I understood instinctively. Of course, that moment just showed me. I mean, I was in an airport with everything I have was basically a little suitcase that I was allowed to carry with me because, it's a sudden expulsion. And I remembered, what rung in my head was these two little verse from a longer poem by Mahmoud Darwish. Ahi ya jurhi al-mukabir, watani laysa haqiba. My home is not a suitcase. And I looked and all I could see is that suitcase, And I was in the middle of the unknown. I mean, I had no idea where I'm going to end up. I have no idea what's going to happen to me. It was just a sense of complete, not just helplessness, but also confusion. Like the future seems completely blocked. I said earlier that the Nakba can be thought of as a structure and not just an event. And this actually comes from, I think, a Palestinian human rights lawyer who kind of tried to define the Nakba basically as a structure, as an organizing structure of Palestinian life. I'm reading here from an article on The Nation. Track form, the Nakba is a structure that serves to erase the group dynamic, the attempt to incapacitate the Palestinians from exercising their political will as a group. It is the continuous collusion of states and systems to exclude the Palestinians from materializing their rights to self-determination. In its most material form, the Nakba is each Palestinian killed or injured, each Palestinian imprisoned or otherwise subjugated, and each Palestinian dispossessed or exiled. The human rights lawyer here is Rabia Ighbariya. The definition itself here, like I said, was not something that I could understand at an emotional, experiential level until that moment. And of course, at that moment, I hadn't really read that definition. But it's the sense that when we say that the Nakba is an ongoing event, it was the idea that no matter where you are, no matter how much you accomplish in life, if you are Palestinian, this is something that can happen to you. You can never, ever feel safe in feeling like you have home, you have stability, you have community, or you have human rights. Everything that you build can be taken away from you immediately. And you're helpless. And there's this sense of confusion, incapacitation, helplessness, and a blocked horizon where you don't know what's next. So this is, it's we talk about 1948, but if we actually apply this definition, it would be something that actually precedes 1948. This denial of collective rights, but also the denial of our very existence as a people. I'm still kind of coping with the death of my father, who died earlier in March, about 6 weeks ago. A few scenes in my head. The first is when, that time in the airport when I had to say goodbye to my family, he wasn't there. And I was kind of surprised that he wasn't there. And that's when they told me that he's not well. My father started to exhibit symptoms of dementia after my arrest. And part of me did not understand just how bad it was on that day itself. I'm going to fast forward a lot to 2023, last year, when I managed to see my family for the first time in many years. My father's condition had deteriorated a lot. He, of course, before my arrest, he was a cardiologist working in the United Arab Emirates. And I remember climbing, they live in this kind of narrow house in Canada now. And, he had his own room on the second story. And I remember climbing this narrow staircase and then looking like and seeing him in the room to the side. And he wasn't fully awake. He was kind of asleep, leaning to the side, drooling a little bit. And I walked up, stood in the room, and I could feel so much heaviness. I could feel like I'm standing. How can a shadow feel so heavy? Because it feels like I'm standing in the shadow of something very big. And I can, it's this, whatever it is so heavy that even its shadow feels heavy. And immediately, the first thing that came to my mind is that I'm standing in the shadow of the Nakba. And again, almost instinctively, the next thought in my head is like, I'm also standing in the shadow of the Holocaust. A little bit before, I was told that my father was not feeling well, that he was sick, and that it's become critical and I should go to Canada to see him before it's too late. I actually, from the beginning of the current genocide in Gaza, it was difficult for me to speak to my family, especially my mom. We didn't know how to speak about Gaza. We didn't really know how to speak. I mean, we're all in immense pain over what's happening, especially that it kind of explodes all of our intergenerational traumas, because this is something we've seen repeatedly, generation after generation. And we didn't know. I mean, we would speak, we would text, and we wouldn't be able to really get in, like we're almost not speaking about, like it's almost like the elephant in the room in every conversation, we don't speak about it. At some point we managed to actually sit down, me and my mom, and Fadwa was there, and maybe having her there made it easier for us to actually have the conversation, and then my mom started speaking, and it was heartbreaking, but it was also kind of cathartic. And she talked about the news of the day, about Gaza, about what was happening at the time. But she also mentioned our initial expulsion from Palestine and how my father at the time was a toddler. He was 4 months old. She told me about how scared they were in the boat. They left from Yaffa on boats. She mentioned how my grandmother would hold up, you know, she would carry him up on her shoulder, above her shoulder, because there's so much seawater coming into the boat and she wanted to protect him from the water splashing on his face. She mentioned how, you know, eventually they would actually end up in Gaza, and then they would be reunited, you know, like because the men and the women kind of separated from each other and they were reunited when they crossed over into Egypt. Throughout all of this, she's crying, and it felt like she looks over because he's in the room and she would look over, and it felt like the Nakba lived with her in the room. It felt like my father was a visual representation of the Nakba. Final scene I'll mention is when he passed. And right after his passing, it was right before Fajr. This was in Ramadan, last 10 days of Ramadan. And our immediate reaction, of course, was to text family. There's so much community destruction that comes with the Nakba. The destruction of Palestinian families, the separation of Palestinian families. I mean, until, it's curious because I started the story talking about the airport. And for as long as I remember, even before I got stuck in the airport was not a nice place for me, because even as a kid, I was afraid of airports. I mean, I was only maybe four years old when the first time I experienced tension in an airport, and that was when I was trying to cross the border with my mom. My mom has a Jordanian passport. She's Palestinian with a Jordanian passport. And until my expulsion, I had a refugee's travel document. Actually, until last summer, I was always a stateless refugee, legally speaking. So my first exposure into this tension, the idea that airports are not nice places, is when I was 4 years old. And I was separated from my mom, because my mom went and stood in the citizens line because she's a citizen, and she had two young boys with her, my son, my brother, who was a toddler at the time. And then she was asked to go back and stand in the line with the refugees, even though she's a citizen. Because why? Because she has two refugee kids with her, and she cannot even pass citizenship to them. And of course, you don't remember the incident when you're a kid, but you remember the emotions, especially the emotions of your parents. And all I remember is just how upset my mom was. And later on, I would know exactly what happened, because the passport control officer said something like, it's your fault. Why did you marry a Palestinian? Like, why would you do this to your kids, marry a Palestinian and have them, you know, be born refugees? What's especially painful is probably the passport control officer has Palestinian roots himself. A lot of people in Jordan are. But also airports were associated in my imagination or my psyche with people falling apart, people feeling like people hugging their family for the first time in years, people saying goodbye to their family without knowing when they can even meet them. Airports were kind of like this always closed door to freedom, but also sometimes a prison. So anyway, back to my father's passing and us kind of trying to communicate and text relatives and let them know that this has happened. And then realizing that he hasn't seen this brother for 15 years. He hasn't seen this other brother for 10 years. He hasn't seen this other brother or sister for such a long time. And the idea that we have so much family around the world that we don't know. I mean, the last time I was able to meet some of them, sometimes when I was like 17, I'm turning 47 next month. When I was 17, some others when I was 12. This idea that you're not even allowed, like you can't form family in one place without that being shattered at some point. Separation from your loved ones. You can't even assume that you can see them whenever you want. And the fact that eventually when he was buried, so far away from anything that he would consider home. This was in a tiny Canadian town, somewhere in New Brunswick. We have no community there. Nobody knows us. He doesn't know anybody. My father was a cardiologist who saved lives for all of his career. He was a doctor. Nobody who was touched by him, nobody who was treated by him could be there. It was only me and my brother having to carry all of that. So yeah, this is the Nakba for us. I told you my experience as someone who is a refugee, who's a lifelong refugee, whose experience of the Nakba is this. It's communal destruction, expulsion, separation from family, inability to form roots, constantly trying to find home. There are other Palestinians you might speak to, and their experience would be different. I'm sure that people living in Gaza, their experience is different. People living Palestinian citizens of Israel, their experience would be different. People in the West Bank would be different. Refugees who are in Lebanon or in Jordan or elsewhere, their experiences will be different. And some experiences might be contradictory, but this is what the Nakba means to me. حسني ما ناسي هذه عوام را الخطر مجروح فات وفات وفات الوقت عمري را حسني ما ناسي هذه عوام را الخطر مجروح فات وفات وفات الوقت عمري را حسني ما ناسي هذه عوام را الخطر مجروح فات وفات وفات الوقت عمري را حسني ما ناسي
I had to put St. Levon back on because I really just have no words to say after listening to Iyad. I've heard it multiple times, but there's just so much to think about, unpack, and discuss. It's just really so profound. And of course, that's part of what I will be doing with you going forward on this show. But for now, I had to leave it to St. Levant, who is saying, "O time passed, and it passed, my beloved, but we won't forget, even though the years pain us." We are out of time for now, but thank you for spending this time with me. We won't forget. We will never forget. See you soon, hopefully very soon, for another This Week in Palestine.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Ian Lucas again. I'm just dropping right back in to tell you that, starting with this episode, This Week in Palestine is going to be released as a podcast. I'm not entirely sure what the schedule is going to be. We're still working that out. But what I love about releasing it into RSS feeds as a podcast is we have show notes. So we can share links with you, such as a link to all of Adampa Pei's doc, links to the Kowakabi Foundation, links to St. Levant's most recent releases, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this type of information will be included in the show notes for this podcast when it is released as a podcast, and I will, in the show, be announcing when it is coming out, and I really look forward to you being able to find it where you find all of your other podcasts, but also being able to share follow-up information with you, because there's so much to talk about. We don't always have time to get into the nitty-gritty of it, but that doesn't mean you can't. So thank you very much. I'll see you next week.